Much of the American West has been suffering from extreme drought this year, with California running out of water and wildfires breaking out in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. But there is a bright spot, or rather a green spot, New Mexico, where unusually heavy late summer rains have arrived. NPR's John Burnett sent us this postcard.
It's a remarkable sight. The high desert, normally the color of baked pie crust, has been transformed.
We now have this green carpet covering all the flat mesas, the lowlands, and we're just not used to seeing a pistachio green color in the landscape out here. It's very, very unusual.
Kurt Kempter is a geologist who lives in Santa Fe and takes frequent hikes in the Piedra Lumbre, the Valley of Shining Stone that captivated the artist Georgia O'Keeffe near Abiquiu, New Mexico. At this moment, he's sitting in the shade of a piñon pine, looking out past 165-million-year-old cliffs of yellow, cream, and red onto a positively verdant desert floor. And in terms of living things, it's not just the yellow paper flowers, the Indian paintbrush, verbena, and snakeweed that have exploded.
The insect population's good. I've seen a tremendous surge in the swallow colonies building on the canyon cliffs. You know, there's good food everywhere, so lots of rabbits out. Coyotes then are plump and healthy, so it's just good times in the desert.
This and a part of the West that has suffered through a punishing drought for the last 3 to 4 years. All over New Mexico, arroyos have been dry. Fearsome windstorms covered everything in dust. Farmers had to pump groundwater for their chili and alfalfa fields. Cattle ranchers were forced to buy expensive hay trucked down from Colorado. The whitewater outfitters have been grumbling about low flows. And then last month, like an answer to a prayer, the monsoons arrived. The National Weather Service's description, abundant moisture, slow-moving storms, is music to the ears of New Mexicans, as is the late afternoon thunder. Forecasters say the drenching rains are the result of backdoor cold fronts charging down from Colorado, colliding with monsoonal Pacific moisture coming up from the south. In the past few weeks, the drought map over New Mexico has turned from the deep brown of exceptional drought to the sandy color of moderate drought. No one knows if this means the drought is over, but it's certainly given way to widespread hope that the years-long dry spell may finally be easing. Now, they pray, just bring us a thick winter snowpack. John Burnett, NPR News.
Most of us don't really give it a thought. We turn on the tap, pour a glass of water, and drink it down. But writer Charles Fishman says by taking our water supply for granted, we ignore big problems. He's author of the book The Big Thirst, and he joins me now. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And it's been a busy time. We have seen that toxic algae bloom on Lake Erie. Last week, there was a massive water main break in Los Angeles. 20 million gallons of water were spilled. And then earlier this year, we saw the chemical spill into West Virginia's Elk River that fouled the drinking water supply. Three really different water problems, completely different causes. But to you, are they linked?
I think it's really important to see them as part of one pattern. And I would add the California drought and Lake Mead, the largest reservoir in the U.S., is now lower than it has been any time since it was filled. Here's what connects all those things. Our water system was designed 100 years ago. It was a remarkable engineering achievement. It's really brilliant. The reason we don't think about it is because of its brilliance. The water is unfailingly safe. It's really the best water system in the world. And it's totally reliable. What links what's been happening just this year, just in the last 7 months, is that the water system's being overtaken. The out-of-date nature of the water system is popping up all over. The regulations are out of date and the pipes are out of date. And our attitude is out of date.
Well, let's talk about the pipes. There aren't a lot of people who I know who have a favorite water main, but I gather that you do.
I do have a favorite water main. It happens to be right here in Washington, D.C., under K Street, where all the flossy lobbying firms are headquartered. it's actually the same size as the water main that broke in L.A. It's a 30-inch water main, so very large. It was installed in Washington, D.C. in 1860, before Abraham Lincoln moved into the White House. Hmm. And it's in use every day. It has been in use every day for the last 154 years. And that's just kind of amazing.
But Charles, couldn't you look at that and say, hey, that water main is doing great. It's been there for 154 years. That's a testimony to how robust our system is.
It is exactly that. But there's a larger point. The water main that broke in L.A. was 93 years old. Los Angeles Water will tell you they are on a 300-year water main replacement cycle. Washington used to be on a 300-year water main replacement cycle. Now we're on a 200-year water main replacement cycle. We're not actually planning to replace most of the water mains anytime in our lifetime or the lifetime of our kids or their kids. And the reason isn't because they probably don't need to be replaced. The reason is because we don't pay attention to the water system and we don't pay enough for the water we use to cover modernizing the system.
You're saying we should be paying more for our water. You're saying we're getting a pretty good deal.
We get a great deal. The average water bill is $34 a month for an American family. Basically, all the water you need costs a dollar a day. The truth is that if everybody paid 10 bucks a month more on their water bill, we could step up the improvement of the water system. But there are things that don't cost any money. It's not just the pipes that are out of date. The regulations are out of date. And we need to step up and modernize how we manage our water as well as the pipes themselves.
What kinds of regulations, what new management practices would you want to see?
I think there are two really important things. For me, the most important thing is most communities do not have a secondary water supply. The problem in Charleston and the problem in Toledo was both those cities relied on one place for their water. Most big cities should have a second source of water, and the easiest additional source of water would be a water recycling plant. The technology exists. It's totally bulletproof to take the water that a community already uses, clean it, and use it again. And the second thing is we haven't looked at what's in drinking water supplies in 30 or 40 years really hard. A perfect example is what happened in Toledo. The toxin that the Toledo water utility found in the water, they weren't actually required to look for it.
Mm.
And there were no standards for what level it should be, what level is safe. There weren't even standards over the weekend for how to measure what was in the water. There are lots of things going into our wastewater, which ends up in our water supply, that didn't even exist 40 and 50 years ago. You think about all the medicines that people take now every day. So we need to take a step back and say, what's the right way to grab hold of our water supply? We're seeing this sort of popcorn popping of problems everywhere. The nice thing about water is all water problems are solvable, just like the leak in the roof of your house is solvable. They aren't solvable if you close your eyes. They aren't solvable if you ignore them.
Charles Fishman is author of the book, The Big Thirst. Charles, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
A giant algae bloom is still making the waters in the western part of Lake Erie look more like pea soup. Toxins from that muck seeped into the water supply of Toledo, Ohio last weekend. For 2 days, nearly 500,000 people were banned from using tap water. Just ahead, we'll explore the state of the country's water systems. But first, the cause of the algae proliferation is no mystery. It's farm runoff. And as Sarah Jane Tribble of member station WCPN reports, farmers are now on the defensive.
Purple dragonflies play on the banks of a shallow creek that runs through Ron Schimming's farm. The creek winds its way into Lake Erie, about 6 miles down from his 400 acres of soybeans and corn crops.
They shouldn't be placing all the blame onto us.
Schimming is referring to the recent Toledo water crisis. There's been a lot of talk about farm runoff as a major cause of Lake Erie's algae problem. Schimming doesn't deny that, but he says he's only using the fertilizer that he needs.
We put the minimum on that we can put on because the crop can only absorb so much, and you're wasting your money completely. If you put an extra 2 pounds on, you've wasted your money because it just does not use it.
40 miles south, Paul Herringshaw walks through his soybean fields.
That's going to be a two-bean pod instead of a three.
He says farmers actually have been working for decades to reduce fertilizer runoff into the lake. Many farmers have cut back or stopped tilling.
We implemented such things as minimum till, no-till, conservation tillage, as an idea to keep the soil in its place with the hope of preventing the runoff of nutrients.
Indeed, right after the water crisis, the Ohio Farm Bureau, which represents 60,000 farmers across the state, went on the offensive, sending a representative to Toledo and offering reporters a list of farmers to interview. The Bureau has long promoted proper fertilizer techniques. So have local county conservation programs. Mike Libben is with the Ottawa Soil and Water Conservation District.
It affects all of us around here, so we're trying to do the best we can and, you know, show that there are some different ways we can hopefully help make better water quality.
Water quality experts are still trying to understand why phosphorus from crop fertilizer is seeping into the lake at rates not seen in decades. And there is growing concern that the algae is feeding off of other sources, such as runoff from livestock farms and sewage plants. Most experts still believe that phosphorus is the main cause of algae on the lake, and efforts to improve the water largely focus on farming. Earlier this summer, Ohio lawmakers passed a measure requiring most farmers to be certified before applying fertilizer. But it's unclear how much this will affect the lake.
I went out last night. You could hear the wash of the waves, and what I saw was putty, literally green putty.
Sandy Benn is Lake Erie's water keeper.
The water wasn't even like water anymore. It is disgusting. It is putrid. It's awful.
Yet, Ben doesn't lay all the blame on the farmers. Instead, she says other sources, such as sewage and livestock, should be considered as well. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Jane Tribble.
If you're an animal lover, zoos are a mixed bag. It's amazing to be in shouting distance of magnificent wild animals, but it's hard not to get the feeling that the great apes, big cats, and other creatures don't exactly love being behind bars and walls. Now, a Danish architectural firm is working with a zoo safari in Denmark to break down those walls and create what they're calling Zootopia. Architect Bjarke Ingels runs the architecture firm the Bjarke Ingels Group, or BIG. He's designing the zoo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you're known already for big ideas at BIG. Before we talk about the zoo, could you tell us some about your other innovative designs for buildings?
Right now we're building a power plant in Denmark that turns waste into electricity and district heating. But it's also made in such a way that you can actually hike on its roof. It's a giant public park. Hmm. And in the winter, you can ski on it.
Nice. So why did you decide to take on the zoo?
For the zoo, it's almost a question of trying to find ways of actually creating a successful cohabitation between humans and different species of animals. We've done a lot of homes for humans. To get to work for new species, it would be a great challenge.
So this is in the concept stage right now, but can you describe what it's going to be like to walk into Zootopia?
First of all, to understand Zootopia, you have to understand that in Zootopia, there's only going to be social animals. You won't have a lonely tiger walking around inside a cage. You'll have gorillas, you'll have wolves, all kinds of animals that like to be together in larger groups, so we can actually create entire habitats. And then secondly, we've organized it in such a way that you start by arriving in something that almost looks like a giant tilted crater. You can walk along the rim of the crater and get amazing views out over the entire landscape of Zootopia. And then from this crater, there'll be three giant gates that you can move through that will bring you into either America, Asia, or Africa. We have organized Asia so that you can visit it with water bicycles. You can bicycle through the area that is Africa, and then you can actually take a cable car through the area that is America. So essentially the idea is interfacing with the animals in completely new ways.
How close, though, can you interface with an animal like a lion when there aren't, you know, traditional walls and bars? I mean, how do you work that out with, well, let's talk through some different animals, like the lion, for instance.
You'll still be able to drive through the lion park with your car in the traditional car safari way. What we're basically looking at is to find different ways of hiding the barriers between the people and the animals. And in this case, what we've tried to do is to eliminate all traces of human architecture. So there are no buildings. You'll see rolling hills growing over the areas where the lions have to retreat when the winter gets cold in Denmark. And in a similar way, using combinations of level changes, trenches with water where the water depth prevents certain animals from crossing. In the case of the bears, your cable car might actually come really close to the bears above them, but it won't bring you within range. So you can say both the human experience and the animal experience is going to be much more exciting. I really do think that if you can make great zoos where so many different species can live in close proximity in harmony, you can also make great cities.
Look forward to seeing this.
Yeah, come over in 5 years.
Great. Architect Bjarke Ingels runs the architectural firm BIG. Thanks for your time today.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, if you can still fit in a beach trip before summer ends, you may or may not notice that we are losing some swimming companions. Millions of sea stars, or you can call them starfish if you're not a marine biologist, have been quietly dying off. Dina Pritchett reports on why.
For over 30 years, biology professor Bruce Menge has been coming to Boiler Bay on the Oregon coast. As the sun rises and the waves crash, he checks the tide pools for sea stars. But this year, things look different.
You see how the arm is twisted like that? And see there's a white spot? So that white spot is a lesion.
It's the early stages of sea star wasting syndrome. Eventually, they just dissolve.
The first time we did our surveys, we found about 1,400 animals. That was in mid-April. And now, last time we were over there, there are like 270. Yeah, they're going fast.
The first time that we really became aware that it was occurring was up in the Olympic Peninsula.
Ecologist Pete Raimondi at the University of California at Santa Cruz has been mapping the outbreak. Those first cases showed up last summer.
And then we started seeing the same sort of symptoms down in Monterey. And from those two points, it popped up all up and down the coast.
The disease has wiped out sea stars from Baja California all the way up to British Columbia. And reports are coming in from the East Coast as well. Now, there have been other cases of wasting disease in the past, but those were different. They hit just a few areas, and Raimondi says they were pretty clearly linked to El Nino.
We knew absolutely when the warm water turned off, the disease would also turn off, and that's not the case this time. And so this one's much spookier than in the past.
What's causing this outbreak is a difficult question.
There's roughly 10 million viruses per milliliter of seawater. There's a million bacteria per mil of seawater. And this is the same seawater that flows through the veins of the sea stars.
Microbiologist Ian Hewson is part of the team that's trying to figure out which of these millions of possibilities is causing the disease. But even if scientists find it, they still need to know what's letting it take hold.
For example, you know, if we are under stress conditions, we tend to get sick. And the same thing occurs to animals in the marine environment.
And that marine environment has lots of possible stressors for a sea star.
The oceans, as they absorb more carbon dioxide, are becoming more acidic. There's also temperature changes. There's also environmental pollutants. For example, everything from agricultural runoff through to little nanoparticles put out by the pharmaceutical industry.
Hewson says that figuring this out could take months, if not years. And by then, the coast could look very different. Oregon State's Bruce Menge says cute little sea stars are actually predators. If they're not around, the things they eat, like mussels, could take over, which can affect the whole ecosystem.
The local diversity of a species will be greatly reduced in abundance or maybe eliminated.
But there may be some hope. Menge says that baby sea stars that hatched right when the epidemic hit are just starting to wash back in from the ocean.
We think they are less affected by the disease than the big ones. So that is a possibility for a recovery.
But while these little ones seem less affected, they still do get sick. And so we still don't know whether the sea star population as a whole will recover or continue to waste away. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
The governor of Colorado is convening a special task force to work on resolving conflicts between residents and the state's oil and gas industry, conflicts arising from fracking. And the agreement on that task force has made the political establishment in the state breathe a huge sigh of relief. From member station KUNC, Dan Boyce explains.
Colorado has been the focus of a lot of attention recently because of high-profile disputes resulting from new oil and gas operations getting closer to homes and communities. Here's Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper trying to put some of that attention to rest.
We're here to announce our intention to create a task force that is charged with that goal.
A task force bringing together industry, environmentalists, and the community. And he unveiled it on the very day signatures were due for a handful of competing oil and gas ballot measures.
The way this compromise is reached is by pulling back all four of those ballot initiatives.
Two anti-fracking initiatives competing against two pro-industry initiatives. These cropped up after Plan A failed. State lawmakers were unable to pass a compromise. Now, the task force will make recommendations to the legislature for 2015.
I wasn't a part of the compromise.
Republican State Representative Jerry Sonnenberg was leading one of the pro-industry ballot measures. He had no intention of pulling his initiative until he received a call from his oil and gas connections.
They needed stability for their stockholders so they could continue to do business without a cloud of a ballot initiative.
See, if these measures would have made it on the ballot, the state was looking at a record-breaking political ad spending showdown in the tens of millions of dollars. Floyd Cerulli is an independent pollster and Colorado political analyst. He says industry didn't want that. Governor Hickenlooper didn't want that.
The entire Democratic Party establishment came out against it, with the exception of Mr. Polis.
He's talking about Colorado Congressman Jared Polis, a self-made tech millionaire who's been making a name for himself in national politics as well. This year, he was putting all his financial and political weight into supporting both of the anti-fracking initiatives. Yet, when Governor Hickenlooper announced his task force, right next to him,
I'm very glad to stand with the governor today to present a thoughtful path forward.
Congressman Polis. Political analyst Floyd Cerulli says Polis was under ever-increasing pressure to back down.
I think that the pressure got so large that he began weighing the risks.
The risks of splitting Democratic voters. Both Governor Hickenlooper and Democratic Senator Mark Udall are running for re-election this November. Both came out against the anti-fracking ballot measures that many of their environmentalist constituents strongly supported. Cerulli says Hickenlooper and Udall's campaigns would have been drowned out by the political ad war over those initiatives.
A significant part of which was going to attack them as being on the wrong side of the environment.
The truth is, there are a number of people within the Republican Party that are not happy with me.
Again, this is Republican State Representative Jerry Sonnenberg, who pulled his pro-industry ballot measure.
Because they do think that was a political tool that would have hurt Democrats.
But he says he's been convinced the oil and gas industry will be better off with this Plan C, this task force compromise. And it's a plan Colorado politicians hope could be a model for other energy-producing states. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Denver.